Welcome to Audio Notes. My name is Haeyeon Park, and I'll be your host today as we explore the remarkable third and final Carte Blanche concert of the 2025 Music in Menlo Festival. These performers will surely be remembered for years to come as we celebrate pianist Gilbert Kalish turning just recently 90 years young. Mr. Kalish has been a central figure in American classical music for decades as a performer, teacher, and collaborator. His influence has touched generations. And of course, he has a long and meaningful connection with music in Menlo. Now, usually on a birthday, the person being celebrated is the one receiving gifts. But instead, Mr. Kalish has chosen to give us, the audience, a gift. The gift of this meaningful recital. He has crafted a bold and personal program that reflects his tastes, his voice, and so much of what he wants to share through music. With the help of several friends, Mr. Kalish will present a Bach keyboard partita, Webern's short works for cello and piano, and for violin and piano. And he will close the program with Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire, a landmark piece in the history of Western classical music. We had the chance to speak with Mr. Kalish and ask him how he chose this fascinating program. Here's what he shared with us.
The center of the program is the Pierrot Lunaire. You know, when I was asked, given the opportunity to have a program and to sort of design it, I thought this is a very significant work of the whole 20th century, of which I am a large part of my life has been spent in the 20th century. And it's an unusual piece. It's a piece that was used constantly after it was written as a kind of template for a lot of the contemporary music of the 20th century. Webern was, of course, a student of Schoenberg's. And you can say, why did I put on Bach? Well, Bach is the fount of everything and beloved of Schoenberg, who wrote also fugues and wrote technical books about music and composition. And so it's also, in terms of the ear of the listener, a refreshing kind of difference.
The concert opens with Johann Sebastian Bach's keyboard partita number 6 in E minor. The word partita has meant different things over the years, but in Germany it gradually came to refer to a collection of connected dance movements. Bach's 6 keyboard partitas represent the peak of his early keyboard suite writing and stand as some of the most sophisticated works of their kind in the Baroque repertoire. All 6 partitas were published together in 1731 as Clavier Practice Volume 1, the first of Bach's works to appear in print. In these pieces, Bach both honors and expands the traditional dance suite, while they include the standard sequence of dances, Allemande, Krangt, Sarabande, Gieg. Bach enriches the form with varied opening movements, elaborate textures, contrapuntal brilliance, in a remarkable range of expression and emotion. We had the chance to ask Mr. Kalish about his thoughts on Bach's partitas and what draws him to this music. Here is what he shared.
The 6 partitas are great. The 6 partitas are his opus 1. These are the first pieces that he wanted to give that title to. So there are 6 of them. They're early in his career, and they sort of begin to record who Bach will be and who he is. You know, at the same time, he has the English suites, the French suites, that he wrote series of pieces that had movements of different dances in them. So in a way, he was exploring old music in a different way, you could say, as Schoenberg was too. These were not pieces meant to be danced to, but they were reflections of those kind of pieces like Gieg, like Courant, Sarabande, different classical dances of the generations preceding Bach. So it was a big exploration in his life too.
The partita number 6 in E minor that Mr. Kalish will perform is the final and the most monumental of the set. The piece opens with one of Bach's most profound opening movements, titled Toccata. With its sweeping improvisatory arpeggios and bold striking chords, the toccata sets a mood of dark intensity, immediately signaling that this is no ordinary suite of dances. This is something grander, more ambitious. Interestingly, the toccata also contains a carefully constructed three-voice fugue in the middle, creating an ABA form. The freer improvisatory sections frame the most structured, strict musical form, the fugue. Next comes the Allemande, a dance that still carries some of the toccata's weight, but with its dotted rhythms, it feels gentler, more elegant in character. The corrente, in contrast, is an Italian dance full of nimble, lively rhythms. The corrente is followed by a short and delicate air that lightens the mood. An extra movement Bach adds to break up the heavier material. At the heart of the partita lies the sarabande, a slow, intense, and soulful movement. Here, we feel echoes of the toccata's darkness with arpeggiated textures and rich chords, while the dotted rhythms and ornaments recall the earlier Allemande. Bach then adds a brief tempo di gavotta, another extra dance like the air, which brings a light moment of delight before the final, most intense movement. The jig that closes the partita is truly something special. It features a double fugue. Like the fugue we heard earlier in the toccata, the jig's first fugue subject is intense and chromatic, creating relentless forward drive. ¶¶ astonishing, the second fugue theme is the exact inversion of the first, a brilliant example of Bach's contrapuntal mastery. Combined with Jig's lively dotted rhythms and flamboyant energy, these counterpoints build toward a powerful, exhilarating close. The remaining pieces on the first half of the program are by Anton Webern, an Austrian composer and conductor born in 1883. Webern is best known as a central figure of the Second Viennese School, alongside his teacher Arnold Schoenberg and colleague Alban Berg. His mature works are characterized by extreme brevity, precision, and crystalline textures, often employing serial and 12-tone techniques. However, Webern's early compositions reveal a different facet of his musical personality. The two pieces for cello and piano, written in 1899 when he was just 16 years old, exemplify his initial engagement with the lush harmonies and expressive melodies of the late Romantic tradition. These pieces are gentle soliloquies for the cello, with the piano providing a simple chordal accompaniment. They are marked by quiet poise and restraint. Interestingly, these early works were not published or performed during Webern's lifetime. They were first performed in 1970 by cellist Gregor Piatigorsky and pianist Victor Babin, and subsequently published in 1975. Here's what Mr. Kalish had to share about them.
There are these two pieces for cello that are just on two pages each. They're each a few minutes long. And each are sort of like a little opera. They're full of different scenes in a way. And the thing is, Webern was 16 years old when he wrote them. He wrote them for himself and his mother, who played cello. And they are the sweetest, most romantic pieces that you can imagine, straight out of the 19th century. And it seemed to me it would be interesting for an audience to hear where these composers came from, in a way.
And here's a musical example from the first movement of the cello pieces, titled Langsam, which means slow. The last work on the first half of the program is Four Pieces for Violin and Piano, Opus 7 by Anton Webern, composed in 1910. When Webern moved to Vienna in 1902 to study musicology and composition, he became acquainted with Arnold Schoenberg, who was experimenting with new approaches to tonality and harmony. Webern was deeply influenced by this movement, and his music from this period exhibits a radically condensed style that distills music to its essence, often reducing compositions to just a few minutes while maintaining remarkable structural coherence. The four pieces for violin and piano, Opus 7, exemplify this musical approach. The entire set takes less than 5 minutes to perform, yet each piece is meticulously crafted. This extreme concentration of form and sound material marked the beginning of Webern's experiments that he continued in later works, such as his six bagatelles for string quartet Opus 9 and five pieces for orchestra Opus 10. Here are some additional thoughts from Mr. Kalish.
So then Webern had radical change in his style of writing. So the four pieces for violin, they're in an entirely different and very mature style. His mature style is, in a way, very pointillistic. So notes and registers are all over the place. It's not melodically beautiful. It's beautiful for its sound world. It's an extremely imaginative world for both the pianist and violinist, requiring very soft playing and both quick and slow playing. But it creates an amazing atmosphere, and for me was a kind of nice way of leading into the Pierrot.
And here's a great musical example, a moment from the second piece of Opus 7 titled Rush, which means fast. The third Carte Blanche concert concludes with Arnold Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire, Opus 21, a groundbreaking work that redefined the boundaries of music in the early 20th century. Schoenberg, born in Vienna in 1874, began his career immersed in the lush harmonies of the late Romantic tradition, drawing inspiration from composers like Brahms, Mahler, Strauss, and Wagner. However, by 1908, he ventured into uncharted musical territory, developing what became known as free atonality. This approach broke away from traditional key centers, seeking new methods to organize musical material without relying on established tonal hierarchies. In his diary on March 12, 1912, Schoenberg wrote, quote, "I believe I am approaching a new way of expression," end quote. That summer, he composed Pierrot Lunaire, a work that would become a cornerstone of musical modernism. We asked Mr. Kalish why he chose this monumental piece for his Carte Blanche program.
It was, for me, a very important piece. And since it's my Carte Blanche, it seems to me appropriate. So when I was a young man, maybe 70 years ago, which is ridiculous to think of, there's a group of musicians, young musicians, in school and out of school, who formed an ensemble. So that ensemble was a large ensemble of all the instruments and singers and one pianist. And it was dedicated to exploring interesting repertoire. We were young, we didn't know what we were doing, and we didn't get any money for it, but we were very curious. And one member of the group suggested this piece. And we all said, what? What are you talking about? What is that? But he spoke eloquently about it. And in the group was this young woman singer, Jan de Gaetani, who I had not had personal contact with until that time. And she said, well, I'll take a look at that. It sounds very interesting. So that was probably in 1956 or 7, I would say. And so she took a look at it, and we agreed that we would do it. And so I was out of school. I hadn't even gone to a conservatory. I had no particular future or present or past as a musician, although, of course, I played. But I was sort of in my own track. I was not doing competitions. I also married early. I married in 1958. And so the idea was that I'm supposed to make a living for a wife and myself. And I had very few options in that way. And I was also, of course, interested in what was unusual and new, even though my upbringing was quite traditional, Germanic classics of the classical Romantic era, even very little French music in my particular background. So we were all kind of interested in seeing what this was about. So anyway, when it happened, it sort of made waves. It was a pretty big deal because it was not a piece that was being done. So it was spoken about quite a lot. It became very important for Jan De Gaetani as a singer, and it became very important for me. All of a sudden, I was a new music pianist, even though I didn't play new music. And so it really pushed me in an important direction, even though I was very curious to do new music. It had not been in my studies, basically. I had never really done anything radical. But all of a sudden, I was being asked to do new music things like composers' forums. So it gave me an entrance into the profession that was very important for me. Without that, who knows what would have happened, but it was one of those lucky kinds of situations in which I worked hard, learned something, and all of a sudden I had some options in my life because I was being asked to do things. And that led to, you know, a big entree of mine into the music world. It became a very important piece of my life, and it led to many other things and many other people that entered my life. So that's why I decided to do Piero Lunaire.
Piero Lunaire, always known by its French title, which roughly translates as Moonstruck Piero, is a melodrama commissioned by the Viennese actress and singer Albertine Zimmer, who was renowned for her performances combining poetry recitation with musical accompaniment. Zimmer sought a musical setting for Albert Giraud's 1884 Piero Lunaire poems, works inspired by the moonstruck, melancholic clown figure from Italian Commedia dell'arte, reimagined here by the Belgian poet as a symbol of modern alienation, obsession, and fragmentation. The 21 poems became his Opus 21, divided into three groups of seven, and formally titled 3x7 Poems from Albert Giraud's Piero Lunaire. The first group of poems explores themes of love, sex, and religion. The second turns to violence, crime, and blasphemy. And the third traces Piero's melancholy return to his hometown of Bergamo, haunted by his memories. Here's Mr. Kalish sharing his insight about the text.
The texts are so fantastical, speaking about magical things and fantastical things. It's kind of a Dadaist, almost. Early 20th century poetry, and about clowns, about made up figures, about the comic figures of that time. Stravinsky used often too, and so it has a kind of not realistic sense. The poems are fantastical. They're about searching the moon, about hitting somebody's head and knocking into their heads. And it's all kind of wild images and very picturesque images.
The symbolism runs even deeper. Fascinated by numerology, Schoenberg deliberately crafted the work around patterns of numbers. Schoenberg uses seven-note motifs throughout. The ensemble, if you wish to include a conductor, is made up of seven people, and each poem is structured in 13 lines. Even the day Schoenberg began the piece, March 12, 1912, seems to reflect his obsession with numerological symmetry. Two of the most striking aspects of Biro-Lunaire are its atonality and the use of Sprechstimme. In this work, Schoenberg deliberately separates harmonies, rhythms, and motifs from their traditional goal-oriented tonal functions. Instead of resolving toward a key center, he uses an atonal approach, music that floats without a gravitational tonal pull, which perfectly matches the unsettling, fragmented nature of the poetry and Biro's unraveling psyche. Equally groundbreaking is Schoenberg's introduction of Sprechstimme, a vocal technique that hovers between speaking and singing. The performer doesn't sustain precise pitches, but instead glides through them in a stylized, speech-like delivery. This creates an eerie, expressionist effect, amplifying the grotesque and fantastical mood of the piece. Let's hear what Mr. Kalisch has to say about Biro-Lunaire's atonality and the use of Sprechstimme.
He was a rebel, and he thought that classical music had reached an impasse in which there needed to be some jolt of energy to change its direction, that tonality had gone as far as it could go, that people like even Brahms were stretching the tonality, but more people like Reger, who was his contemporary, were writing sort of tonality that was so far flung from our normal sense of tonality and connections of keys that it was like a new language, and that it had gone as far as it could go. And out of that came his idea of what could one do now. So he, in a sense, invented serial music in which pitches are, in a sense, equal. There's no key center, and it's an exploration of the relationship between pitches. Now, actually, in my opinion, the reality is that Schoenberg is still, in a very essential way, a romantic composer, and that there are key centers in many of the pieces, even though it's hard to discern exactly what they are, and they go wandering. The idea of a vocalist who's not only a singer, not only a speaker, was again quite unique. I mean, in the 19th century, there were monodramas, there were people who narrated, and of course there was song, but there was not a kind of combination of somebody who was both speaking and singing in a certain way. And this requirement of this piece is that the person basically use the extent of their speech, the high and the low of their speech. We all speak on notes, whether we know it or not. What I'm saying now is a note. And even though you don't know what the note is, or I'm not conscious of it being a note, there is a note. And the same when you speak, or when anybody speaks, there is a pitch. And so Schoenberg took advantage of that to formalize it. And so it's not the pitch sounding just like speech. It's a kind of sing-song. And very occasionally, he demands an absolute pitch that it be sung. But most of the piece is done in a kind of a relative pitch. He doesn't put it on the lines as we have our normal staff of five lines and four spaces, but he puts it on a kind of relative pitch above and below that pitch. In fact, the first performer of the piece was not a singer, was an actress. And so it's definitely not singing.
This Sprechstimme technique was the perfect tool to capture the grotesque, surreal mood of Piero Lunaire. Another key aspect of the work is its instrumentation. The influence of Schoenberg's instrumental choices was so profound that this specific configuration, flute doubling piccolo, clarinet doubling bass clarinet, violin doubling viola, cello, piano, and voice, became known as the Piero Ensemble, and is now a standard setup in chamber music, emulated by countless composers. Throughout the piece, Schoenberg constantly shifts and reshapes the instrumental combinations, exploring new, unique, unsettling sonic textures. As mentioned, he also requires many of the players to double on different instruments, drawing maximum color and variety from a small group and amplifying the expressive range of the musical forces.
Another interesting facet is that the wind players and the violinist all double. So the violinist is supposed to play viola too. The flute plays piccolo, of course, and the clarinet plays bass clarinet. And even in one piece goes from B flat clarinet to A clarinet. So they have to be kind of people who are versatile and willing to be flexible.
To provide forward momentum and formal cohesion in place of traditional tonality, Schoenberg leans on a wide range of classical forms and techniques: canon, fugue, rondo, passacaglia, and free counterpoint. Throughout Piero Lunaire, you will hear familiar gestures, a waltz in movements number 2 and 5, a passacaglia in number 8, a minuet in number 16, two fugues and a canon in number 18, a barcarolle in number 20, and more, all woven into an atonal expressionist fabric. While each of the 21 melodramas creates its own vivid, self-contained world, Schoenberg also shapes an overarching narrative structure across the three parts. In part 1, we meet the main Commedia dell'arte characters, Piero, his beloved Columbine, and his rival Harlequin. These opening movements capture Piero in the ecstasy of inspiration, obsessed with Columbine, enraptured by his own artistic vision. Let's listen to the very beginning of the piece, the first movement, Mondesdrunken, which means moon drunk, which immediately sets the eerie tone.
Thank you.
plunges into a grotesque night of sacrilege and madness. As Pierrot wrestles with disturbing, hallucinatory visions, reaching a climax in his imagined decapitation by the moon. Here's what Mr. Kelly shares about the first movement of Part 2, Nacht, the Night, and how it connects back to what we just heard.
Well, number 8, I think, which is also to give people a sense of the sounds of Schoenberg, that's bass, clarinet, piano, and I think cello. So bass, clarinet, his exploration of that register of music, the deep bass. And there's also some motivic things in this piece, as in many classical Germanic pieces. So that piece starts on a major third and features a major third and a minor third. And that's da-dee-dum. And that's very characteristic and very important in this whole set. If you see the very beginning, it begins with a major third in the piano and a minor third, dee-da-da. So that's kind of important motive in the piece. So, I mean, although the listener may not quite understand the organization of it, there's a real composer's mind at work in this, and it's highly organized. It's not random at all.
Finally, in Part 3, the mood softens slightly, though it's still haunted. Pierrot grows increasingly melancholy as he returns to his hometown of Bergamo, with memories of his past clinging to him. Here's an example from Part 3, the fifth movement in this final section, number 19, titled Serenade. Listen closely to the striking high writing for the cello. The text even mentions that Pierrot is playing on his oversized viola. Even here, Schoenberg infuses the music with a sense of grotesque transformation, bending the familiar into something strange and unsettling.
The 19th, which is the cello, kind of the cello variation, and has kind of the fantasy of the text, which you'll see, of Pierrot, who looks at the moon and has all these fantastical kinds of images. That's a really important one, I would say.
The last number, O Alter Duft, O Ancient Scent, draws the entire cycle to a bittersweet, nostalgic close. After the intensity and distortion of the earlier songs, this final piece offers a moment of gentle reflection. The premiere of Piero Lunaire took place on October 16, 1912 in Berlin, with Albertine Zimmer performing the vocal part. Zimmer appeared in costume, fully embodying the Piero character, while the instrumentalists were positioned behind the screen, heightening the theatrical and enigmatic atmosphere of the performance. Audience reactions were heightened in its variety. There were reports of both thunderous applause and bewildered indignation, laughter, sharp whistling, and vociferous praise. The premiere was ultimately seen as a major success. Anton Webern, who was present, recalled that while some in the audience resisted, the younger generation in particular responded with unqualified acclaim, recognizing the work as a bold and visionary leap into the future of music. Before we close, we wanted to share why this piece holds such deep personal importance for Mr. Kalish.
Well, the most I'm looking for is that people will feel a special kind of connection to the piece. It's still not done very much. That Schoenberg is for many people a kind of forbidding figure that people are afraid of. That he writes very beautiful music, very imaginative music that you can really relate to. Out of my playing, I just want to be part of the ensemble. It's a very wonderful, intricate, difficult, and beautifully written connection between the instruments. And there's an amazing group of players that we have, and I think we can bring that to the audience.
Ever since its premiere, Piero Lunaire has remained an inexhaustibly fascinating creation, visionary, experimental, and groundbreaking. And yet, like all of humanity's highest artistic achievements, its impact never fades. It remains alive, continually speaking to new generations, and feels as ageless and timeless today as it did over a century ago. This concludes our conversation about the wonderful Carte Blanche presented by Gilbert Kalish. Thank you for listening. I'm Haeyeon Park, and we'll see you soon at the concert. Audio notes are written and produced by Dmitry Atapin and Haeyeon Park in consultation with David Finkel and Wuhan. Many thanks to Gilbert Kalish for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Bach Partita No. 6 in E minor, BWV 830, performed by Gilbert Kalish, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Webern Two Early Pieces for Cello and Piano, performed by Dmitry Atapin Cello and Haeyeon Park Piano, courtesy of Music and Mendel Live. Webern Four Pieces for Violin and Piano, performed by Christine Lee Violin and Gilbert Kalish Piano, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Schoenberg Pierre Le Lunaire, Opus 21, performed by Mary Nessinger, mezzo-soprano, Tara Helen O'Connor, flute piccolo, David Schifrin, clarinet, bass clarinet, Ida Kavafian, violin viola, Fred Sherry, cello, and Peter Serkin, piano, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music in Menlo.